as I got into the business world. And I realized, oh, some of these things, some of these intangible qualities that go into success or failure for me as an individual, as well as for the team, are relevant at work. And one of the most important things that I noticed right away as I started to reflect on my experience as an athlete and look around at some of the people I was working with was appreciation. Most of the best teams I'd ever been on, there was a lot of appreciation for what we were doing, for each other, from the coaches to me as an athlete. And then as I started to look at work teams, I started to see the same thing, that when appreciation exists in relationships and within teams, people can thrive. When it doesn't, people get stressed out, burned out, and upset. So what does this appreciation really mean at work? It's a really simple concept. But one of the things I've learned over studying this and talking to lots and lots of people about this around the world is that we confuse two things that are both important, but they're different, particularly in our professional lives. We confuse recognition and appreciation. They're both important, but they're different. Here's what recognition is. Recognition is positive feedback based on results, based on performance. You produce a result, hopefully you get recognized for it. Sometimes it's formal. Sometimes you might get an award or some kind of bonus or some kind of award or something. Sometimes it might just be someone saying, hey, great job, way to go, a pat on the back. But it's a reaction to something, a job well done, something that we've produced. Appreciation, on the other hand, is about people's value. Recognition is about what we do. Appreciation is about who we are. The best way I know to describe the difference between these two things and why they're important, I'll give you an example from my baseball career. Now, whether you know anything about baseball or not, you may know what happens to the pitcher, which is the position that I played in the baseball game when the pitcher doesn't do well. Do you know what happens? Yeah, they stop the game. And in front of everybody, the manager, the guy in charge, literally walks out to the middle of the field, takes the ball from you, and makes you leave. And you have to walk out off the mound, out of the game. It's pretty embarrassing. I mean, imagine you're at work doing whatever kind of work you do and you make a mistake, like kind of a big one, and someone bursts into the room and says, stop right there. And you have to stop in the middle of whatever you're doing and get up and leave. And some other person comes and sits down in your chair and starts doing your job for you. And imagine thousands of people are watching this happen. You would probably feel a little embarrassed, don't you think? That's what it's like to get taken out of the baseball game as the pitcher. But the worst part of the whole experience was when I would go to sit down on the bench where all my teammates were, nobody would talk to me. Even if you don't like baseball, if you have a chance to watch an American baseball game, just watch. It's best on television too, because the camera will literally follow that guy in, and you'll see what happens is, it's like an unwritten rule in baseball. Oh, leave him alone, he's upset. And yes, I was upset. I had just pitched bad enough, they took me out of the game. But you know what I could have used after just having a bad game and sitting over there on the bench? What do you think? Some appreciation. Not recognition. I mean, if I had done a bad job, what are they going to do? Come over and say, hey, Robbins, way to go, great job. No, that would be phony. That would be inauthentic. So appreciation isn't phony recognition. I didn't deserve any recognition if I'd failed. I hadn't done my job. So like, look, we all have to do our jobs. We have expectations. In that situation, if I didn't pitch well, we're probably going to lose the game. So me not doing a good job was both my responsibility and my personal failure, but also the team's failure. However, what I could have used and almost never got in all those years of playing baseball was for someone to come over and actually appreciate me personally, not for what I had done, but for who I am. What could they have said? I don't know. They could have said, hey, man, that was rough, but you know what? You're an important part of the team. Or, hey, you know what? We got your back. We believe in you, right? Mindfulness and emotional intelligence is about having some social awareness. What does this person need? Appreciation is about letting people know what we appreciate and value about them. Recognition is reacting to people's performance. They're both important, but if we separate them out, we recognize people when they deserve recognition. We appreciate people all the time. You know, I heard Oprah Winfrey speak a few years ago, and she said this really simple but powerful thing. She said, I've interviewed thousands and thousands and thousands of people in my career. I've interviewed everybody. I've interviewed presidents. I've interviewed prime ministers, I've interviewed celebrities, I've interviewed children, I've interviewed criminals, I've interviewed, you name the type of person, she said, I've interviewed them. She said, after all these years and all these interviews, she said, do you know that just about every single person asks me some version of the same question when the interview's over? Interview's over, camera shuts off, they lean over and they say, how'd I do? Or was that okay? Some version of that question. She said, early in my career, I used to be really confused by this question because I would be sitting across from someone who's very successful, very accomplished, and I'd be wondering to myself, are they really that insecure? Do they really need my validation? Like, why are they asking me how they did? She goes, then I realized something. They're not actually asking me how they did. You know what they're really asking me? Did you see me? Did you hear me? Did what I say matter to you? She said, and I agree with her, everybody's asking those questions all the time. It doesn't matter how successful or accomplished they might be. We all want to be seen, we want to be heard, and we want to know not just what we say, but who we are matters. And that's something that we can all do for everybody around us. It takes a certain amount of awareness. It takes some mindfulness. We have to put our phones down or sometimes close the laptop and actually connect with someone eye to eye and heart to heart. If we're on the telephone with them or on a video conference, it's actually making a human connection with that other person. And that sounds simple, and it is, but in today's world, with the pace at which we work, it's actually sometimes a profound act. Glassdoor.com recently did a study, and they always are looking at how people like where they work, if you will. You can leave reviews on Glassdoor for places where you work, or when you leave someone somewhere to let people know how is it actually working there. And they did a study recently, and they found that 52% of people said, I would have stayed at my company longer if I felt more valued and appreciated. They also found that 81% of people said, I'm more motivated to work harder when my boss or my manager actually appreciates me, where only 37% of people said they were more motivated to work harder when their boss was hard on them or they feared losing their job. So the way that we work in today's world and what people really want is authentic appreciation. Now, again, the difference between recognition and appreciation is an important one. I was speaking at an event a few years ago for one of my clients. I often get invited to speak at recognition events where people are getting awards, where they're being honored and recognized for a job well done or for producing a result, which are pretty cool events to be at because everyone's in a good mood. It's for a very positive thing. I was at this event, a couple hundred people at this event, and as I got up to speak about the difference between recognition and appreciation, I said, hey, everybody here, just pair up with someone in the audience and talk a little bit about what was it about winning this award that had you feel most appreciated? And they paired up, and I gave them a few minutes to talk to each other. And then when everybody came back, I said, does anybody want to share what they were talking about with their partner? And a few people raised their hands, and they were sharing. This one man raised his hand, and he stood up, and he said, you know, Mike, I never really thought about it. He said, winning this award's a big deal. I was surprised, you know, getting to come here. It was a trip. They got to take a trip. I got to bring my wife, you know, being here. We don't usually travel without our kids, so just, it's really an amazing experience just to be here. He said, but when you asked us that question, and I paired up with my partner, I shared with him the moment for me that was the most meaningful of this whole experience. He said, when I went home and told my family that I won this award, my son told me he was proud of me. He said, that was the moment for me. He said, look, the trip's great. The award, the whole thing is all great. He said, but that's the moment that I really felt appreciated. And when I ask this question of people all the time to think of a time where they felt specifically appreciated, it's usually not some big deal. It's some simple little interaction. It's a note that someone sent them. It's a message someone left for them. It's just something simple. And there's an exercise that I love to do with teams. And if you work with a group of people, this is a really simple but powerful exercise that you can do. I call this exercise the appreciation seat exercise. And this exercise I will use often. I can do it with a larger group and split people up into smaller groups of 4 or 5, which is great. The best way is when I'm with a group of 10 or 12 people. They all work together, and I'll introduce the idea of the difference between recognition and appreciation, and I'll say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go around the table, and each person is going to have a few minutes to be on the appreciation seat. Now, what that means is when it's their turn, so let's say Susie's sitting over here to my right. When it's Susie's turn, everyone in the group is going to have a few minutes to just express some appreciation for Susie. Now, I usually set it up because I've done this before. Like, look, we may not get to everyone. I'm going to give, you know, I'll put 3 minutes on the clock here, and then the timer will go off. And everyone will have time in that 3 minutes to say some things they appreciate about Susie. And Susie's job, as difficult or uncomfortable as it may be for her, is to just sit there and receive the appreciation from the people on her team. And what's amazing is we have a lot of resistance, by the way, to receiving appreciation, which is kind of funny. We have all these weird social norms that we do. You know what you're supposed to say, by the way, when someone expresses appreciation for you? You know what you're supposed to say? Thank you. Then, shut your mouth. All you have to do is say thanks. But if you listen to yourself and most other people, what comes after the thanks is almost always weird and insincere. We either give them a compliment right back. You too, you're great too. And sometimes we mean it, but sometimes it's just like a knee-jerk reaction. I often think of it like a birthday gift. It would be strange if I came over to your house on your birthday with a gift and I said happy birthday and you went, oh, thanks. And then you ran into the other room and came out with a gift for me. That would be weird, right? But even worse, we argue with people when they give us a compliment or express some appreciation. Oh, no, no, it's nothing. Oh, no, stop. Which is always odd. What are you expecting them to say in response, by the way? Oh, you're right. You're an idiot. I was just kidding. Like, it's the weirdest thing. I'm giving you a gift, a birthday gift. Happy birthday. That would be like you taking the present and smashing it on the floor and going, I don't deserve that. I wouldn't give you any more gifts, by the way. You would offend me and you'd ruin the gift. But so the exercise itself, the hardest part is often sitting there and just receiving the appreciation. You know what's amazing about this? When one human being expresses appreciation for another human being, it raises the serotonin level in both people's brains. It physiologically makes us happier, less stressed. If we do it in a group, like when I do the appreciation seat exercise with a team, it actually increases our level of oxytocin, which connects us, physiologically connects us with each other. So again, 3 minutes for Susie on the appreciation seat. We all take turns, and as many people as can go, express some appreciation for her. Then we'll go to the next person. Let's say it's Antoine. Now it's his turn. Again, 3 minutes for Antoine. And at first, usually when we do the exercise, people are a little funny at first, or they're a little goofy or making jokes. And I usually know just to kind of ride through that a little bit and keep reminding people, let's, you know, be real about this. And, but usually by the second person to the third person, the waterline on the iceberg, which I talked about in the previous segment, people start getting more real. And what's amazing is what gets shared. And sometimes there's some laughs and there's some pats on the back and there's some hugs and even some tears as people express their appreciation for each other. And we go around the room and everybody has a few minutes on the appreciation seat. And inevitably, no matter how many times I've done this exercise, it always goes longer than I think. People start yelling at me, turn off the watch, turn off the timer. I have more to say and I want to go. And it's amazing that I've sat with the group of 10 people and we've spent an hour and 45 minutes having that conversation. And it always blows me away that just a little bit of appreciation goes such a long way. I was at an event a few years ago in Las Vegas for a company. It was their all-company event. They have people all over the country in the United States, and they get together once a year for an annual conference. And I had talked to a few of the people who were at the event on the phone before the event started. And one of the women that I talked to told me a story about when she got promoted to be a manager a few years earlier. One of the executives from the company had called her and left her this voicemail where he just celebrated her and was so excited for her. And she said, you know, that voicemail made me feel so good when I got it. I save it on my phone. And when I'm feeling bad or I'm feeling down, sometimes I'll just listen to it. And so I'm at the event before I go to speak and everyone's wearing name tags. And I recognize the woman's name as I'm standing in line to get some food because I talked to her on the phone and I was like, hey, we talked on the phone. And I said, do you really have that voicemail on your phone? And she pulls out her phone and she plays it for me. And it was a really passionate, very excited message from one of the executives. And I saw the executive who'd left the message because I'd actually talked to him on the phone as well. And I said, does he know that you have that voicemail? And she said, no. And her face got a little red. And I said, do you want to go share it with him? And she was a little embarrassed, but she's like, okay. So we walk over to him, tell the whole story, play the voicemail. He listens to it. We all have a nice chat about it. She walks away and he looks back at me and says, Mike, I don't even remember leaving that message. He said, it's something that I do. When people get promoted, particularly when we promote people from within, it's a big deal. I like to make sure I thank them and acknowledge them and make a big deal about it. He's like, but I don't remember leaving that message. But she had it on her phone and she listens to it every few months when she needs a little pick-me-up. And it was a great reminder for him in that moment, but also for me as he and I were having that conversation. A little bit of appreciation goes a long way. When we do the appreciation seat exercise with teams, what I'm always amazed by when we get done, when we debrief, I usually ask people, how was that? Most people will acknowledge the most difficult or uncomfortable part of it is receiving the appreciation. Although I often say to them, I promise you, you won't forget anytime soon what people said to you today. And on the flip side, though, what people say is it feels so good to give appreciation, to express it. And what we often realize is there are opportunities for us to do that all the time. We just don't do it. We're waiting for some event or some activity or some result or some something. But what if we just did it proactively for no particular reason, just because we wanted to let people know? Look, from a mindfulness perspective, why this is so important, we talk about mindfulness at work. is because appreciation, while it's expressing our appreciation, letting people know the value that they bring for who they are, not just what they do, the mindset we have to take if we're going to be able to express and experience appreciation around us at work is a mindfulness or a mindset, so to speak, of gratitude. Now, the thing about gratitude is it's so simple, but it's easy for us to forget, right? It's how often do we stop on a daily basis and just ask ourselves, what am I grateful for right now? It's one of my favorite questions to ask, by the way. If you call my office on the voicemail, you know what it says? And it's been on there for about 15 years. I've changed the message many times, but it's, hey, sorry we missed you. Leave a message. And in your message, let us know something that you're grateful for. Look at the coolest messages in the office. People call to like sell us stuff and they'll be like, I wasn't prepared for that question. Let me see. I'm grateful for my kids, or I'm grateful for my health, or I'm grateful for something simple. And what I've learned many years ago about asking this question, it's a personal practice that I have. I want to inspire gratitude in other people, but there's a self-serving part of it. Because when I ask other people what they're grateful for, you know what it forces me to do? Stop and think about what I'm grateful for. At least once a week, sometimes two or three times a week. I did it earlier today. I just go on social media and I'll post the question, what are you grateful for in this moment? Because gratitude is a practice. It's a mindfulness practice. And we can bring it into work in lots of different ways. I think of a woman named Erica Fox, who I did some work with at Google a number of years ago. And at the time, Erica was running a learning team that was spread out all across the United States, so a virtual team, which can be challenging. She doesn't get to see her team on a regular basis. And she was struggling with, how do I bring this team together, given that the way we meet is by video conference once a week, and we don't always get a chance to be in person with one another. And she said, after she came to one of the sessions that I delivered, she decided to come up with some creative ideas for how to engage and connect her team. And she said, what I did on the very next video conference meeting that we had, I said to everybody, hey, listen, we're going to go around and I want everyone to share something that they're grateful for. Could be something about work. It could be something about life. Whatever it is, doesn't matter, but just share what you're grateful for. And then take out a post-it note and write the thing on the post-it note that you're grateful for. And then what I'd like for you to do is post it somewhere in your desk or your workspace, like hide it from yourself, because then you'll find it later. And she said at first, she got some eye rolls and people kind of thought it was a little corny. But she said what happened was everybody shared something they were grateful for. And she goes, I noticed that it actually allowed us to connect with each other a little more personally. And it set the meeting tone, if you will, in a positive way to begin with. The next week I did it again. And there were still a few eye rolls, but people got into it a little more. So the third week I did it again. And after three weeks in a row, I thought, you know, maybe I'll stop. Maybe we'll try something different. And I get on our meeting for that fourth week and just jumped into the meeting. And all of a sudden people were upset. Wait, hold on. Where? I got my post-it note. I'm ready to share the thing I'm grateful for. And she said she realized that even some of the people on her team who weren't that into it at first had really gotten into it. And she said over time, what she found was that it started to really build up the connection amongst the people on her team. There was more trust. There was more understanding of each other. And she said when they would get together every couple of months in person, which they did, they started as a team to have a practice where they not only would share things that they were grateful for and they wanted to celebrate, but it made them feel safer, if you will, to share things that they were struggling with or where they'd failed. It actually created more what we call psychological safety for her team. Psychological safety is basically trust at a group level. So think about how this relates to you, to your own work, to the people that you work with, to the work that you do. Where can you infuse appreciation and gratitude? There's a couple of simple practices that I found to be really helpful. One is ask that question. What are you grateful for? Years ago, a mentor of mine said to me this great thing. He said, Mike, you know, gratitude and victimhood can't coexist. So when we're in a place of gratitude, we can't simultaneously be in a place of victimhood. And one of the things that derails us individually and collectively at work is feeling like we're victimized by whatever's going on around us. The other people we work with, the technology, what's going on in the market, you name it, the customers, there's all kinds of stuff that we can justifiably feel like it's not fair. But if we come from a place of gratitude, it's very difficult to get stuck in that place. Another thing that we can do is look for opportunities to express our appreciation for the people around us. As simple as that sounds, we got to find opportunities to do that, right? Like that appreciation seat exercise. Where can you make it safe and conducive to express appreciation for the people that you work with. Maybe you actually write a physical card. You will blow people's minds, by the way, if you actually write them a thank you card. Put it in an envelope, put their name on it, maybe drop it in the mail unless you work with them, drop it on their desk. We don't give cards to each other like we used to. And another thing that we can do, and I mentioned it earlier, but start receiving appreciation from other people more graciously, right? Just say thank you, even and especially if you don't agree with what they're saying, right? Your opinion about my expression of appreciation for you is actually not that interesting to me. And you know what's interesting? Here's something that I've learned over many years. You know, I've interviewed tons of people about this particular topic in my work. And you know what I've never heard anyone say to me? You know what, Mike? I'm just too appreciated. It's just too much. It just bugs me. My coworkers, my spouse, my kids, my friends, my family, they just appreciate me too much. It just gets on my nerves. I've never heard anyone say that. You know why? Because I don't think it's possible to be overappreciated. And if we're honest, most of us feel underappreciated. And one of the reasons why we feel underappreciated is because we get all weird when people express appreciation for us. So if we actually become more comfortable receiving appreciation, a couple things will happen. First of all, we'll get more. And second of all, we'll actually make it more conducive to the environment in which we work for appreciation to be expressed. Right? We talked about in the first segment, authenticity and vulnerability. Expressing appreciation for other people and receiving it is actually a bold and courageous act, and creates a certain amount of vulnerability for us as human beings. And so from a mindfulness perspective, we become more mindful of what we're grateful for, what we appreciate about the people around us. We can not only express it more effectively, but we literally can change the culture of the team or the people with which we work. I've seen this happen many times over the course of all these years of doing this work. And as a way to start to wrap up this particular segment, I want to tell one poignant story about this, because in all my years of doing this work with different types of teams and groups and people in a variety of different work environments, one of my favorite places to get to do work, and I don't do it all that often, but given my sports background, from time to time, in addition to all the companies that bring me in to work with their teams and their leaders, I do get invited to work with athletes, particularly baseball players. And a few years back, this was actually in the spring of 2010, I got a telephone call from the San Francisco Giants, one of the two local professional baseball teams in the San Francisco Bay Area where I live. And I was honored to get that phone call, and they asked me, hey, Mike, would you come in and give a talk to the organization about the power of appreciation? And I said, of course. And I went in and I gave that talk, and the message really resonated. And I got a chance to work with the team a bit and the organization over the course of that season. And I've actually had a chance to work with the San Francisco Giants since then. And what's interesting is the San Francisco Giants actually won the World Series, or the championship in baseball, that 2010 season. And it was a really big deal, not just because they'd never won the championship since the team had moved from New York in the late 1950s. So it was a big deal both in sports but also culturally. But it was also a big deal because they won that championship and they didn't have the best talent. All the experts on paper, when they got into the playoffs the very last day of the season, people said, oh, they're not going to win. They don't have a good enough team. And then they won each round of the playoffs, and then they won their championship, and people were like, wow. But baseball's kind of a funny sport like that. Sometimes you can get hot at the right time and win a championship even if you don't have the best players. But then 2 years later in 2012, the San Francisco Giants won the World Series again. They won another championship, 2 in 3 years, which is very difficult to do. And similarly, that 2012 team on paper didn't look like it should have been the best team. They should have won another championship. And then 2 years after that in 2014, they won another championship. So 3 championships in 5 years, each time with teams that weren't supposed to win, but somehow figured out that whole team chemistry, team culture thing in a way that allowed them to be incredibly successful. And because I've had a chance to watch them both from the outside as a fan, but also work with them inside in the organization, I got some insight on this. And there's two things that happened in back-to-back seasons at the end of the 2013 and 2014 season to me that really epitomize the power of appreciation. The end of the 2013 season, the Giants weren't going to the playoffs. They weren't going to win another championship. They were disappointed with how the season had turned out. I was at the ballpark, one of the last games of the season. They give out a big award that gets voted on by the other players and coaches to basically their most inspirational player. And the player that won that award that year is a guy named Hunter Pence. And Hunter was an all-star player, really good player on the field, but kind of their spiritual or sort of passionate, motivational leader in the clubhouse, in the locker room, so to speak. And he got voted that most inspirational player that year. And when he was receiving his award on the field right before a game, there was about 40,000 people in the stands that night. I was one of them. He walks out onto the field and they had a whole ceremony for him, and he received the award, and he thanked everybody. And at one point in his speech towards the end, he's looking at all of his teammates, and he gets kind of serious, and he says, listen, I want each and every one of you to know that I love you. And he said, I know some of you get uncomfortable when I say that because you think it's soft. He said, I don't think it's soft. In fact, I think it's the most important thing that we have. And I'm sitting in the ballpark listening to him say this to his teammates in front of all those people. And I was really touched by it. I was like, wow. He very passionately, vulnerably expressed his love for his teammates. And it wasn't because they were winning a championship or celebrating something specific, although he was winning an award. It was authentic. It was real. It was full of appreciation and love. And it really touched me. Fast forward to the end of the next season. It's 2014. They're back in the World Series. They're back in the championship. It's game 7. They're on the road in Kansas City. The tying run's on third base. There's 2 outs in the bottom of the 9th inning. Madison Bumgarner, a big burly pitcher for the San Francisco Giants from North Carolina, is about 6'5", about 220 pounds. He gets the final out of the World Series. The guy from Kansas City pops up. The Giants win their 3rd championship in 5 years. And as they're about to celebrate, Bumgarner runs off the pitcher's mound towards home plate, towards the catcher, a guy named Buster Posey, another big, strong guy from Georgia. These two burly, manly men go to embrace each other in the middle of the diamond. As they embrace, Bumgarner leans over and whispers into Posey's ear, I love you. And the whole team comes and jumps on him, and they are celebrating their championship. And I'm sitting in a hotel room in Arizona watching the game on television, super excited that they won. But at that moment, when I see Bumgarner say that to Posey, I think to myself, that's it. That's it right there. That's what really makes a championship team. It's that love. It's that appreciation for one another. It's so simple, but it's powerful. In the work that you do, in the work that I do, in the work that all of us do, can we be mindful enough to pay attention to the people around us, to the work that we're doing, to appreciate the people that we work with, not just recognize them when they do something worthy of recognition, and to be grateful for the work that we do, for the opportunity to do it, for the ability to support ourselves and the people that we love. There's so much for us to be grateful for if we choose to pay attention to it. So if you think about the two things that we've talked about here, in the first segment we talked about the power of authenticity, and in this segment we talked about the power of appreciation. Relatively simple concepts, at least to understand. The more challenging aspect is to be able to practice it. And when we do practice being authentic, and we do practice appreciating not only the people that we work with, but being grateful for the work that we do, it allows us to be more effective and more successful and ultimately more fulfilled, and it allows us to have the kind of impact we want to have on the people around us. And that's what it really takes for us to be mindful at work. Thanks.
Your next presenter is Dr. Amishi Jha, who will introduce you to the neuroscience of attention and make the case that mindfulness training is an effective form of brain training.
Whether it's being more effective in our job or as a parent or a spouse, being more resilient to the challenges that life brings us, being more giving or kind or connected, experiencing more awe and joy in our lives. There are many reasons we'd like to train the brain. This is just giving us a sampling of what that is.
Lecture 11. The benefits of brain training.
Dr. Amishi Jha is a neuroscientist and associate professor of the Department of Psychology at the University of Miami. She studies the neural basis of attention, working memory, and the effects of mindfulness-based training programs on cognition, emotion, and resilience. Amishi is one of the most extraordinary thinkers and researchers of our time, and I'm delighted that she's joining us on this journey.
It's my great pleasure to talk to you today about the neuroscience of mindfulness. Obviously, this is a very big topic, and to give you a sense of the kind of slice through it that we'll take, I'd like to give you a little bit of background on who I am and the kind of research I do in my own laboratory so that you know where I'm coming from with regard to the perspectives I'll take and some of the research that we've conducted. So I am a cognitive neuroscientist, which means that I study how it is that the brain is able to instantiate the mind in different cognitive functions, in particular, the functions of attention. So in my laboratory, we use various types of brain imaging technologies, functional MRI, event-related potentials, or ERPs, as well as behavioral methods. And through these methods, what we've been able to learn is that, and maybe this is obvious to most, attention is an incredibly powerful brain system. It's needed for almost everything we do to allow us to have fluid and complex behavior in our world. But it ends up that we've learned through this research that attention is also quite vulnerable. And the top three aspects of our human condition that actually cripple, or in some sense can be thought of as kryptonite for attention, are stress, poor mood, and threat. If it were possible to live in a world in which we'd never experience these things, that would be tremendous. But that's not the human condition. So what we've been very interested in doing is trying to see if there are ways in which we might be able to train the brain, in particular train the brain's attention system, to be stronger and more resilient to these aspects of functioning in daily life that are compromising it. That's how our work comes to mindfulness training. So you'll understand that the perspective I take is really with regard to brain training as it relates to mindfulness training. In my lab, we look at a whole host of populations, and what one thing they happen to have in common is that they experience what we call a high-stress interval. These are demanding periods of time over which they have not only to perform well, but they may have to learn new tasks, get training in new types of content. And this could be a few weeks to several weeks. So some of the examples are students going through the academic semester, or elite athletes or college athletes that are enduring preseason training, or accountants and other business professionals in which they have to dedicate and use their attention in a very precise fashion over multiple months, for example, tax season. And a very large group that we work with are military personnel as well as military spouses. We track them and work with them over pre-deployment training intervals in which the demands are intensive, but the whole intention is to ready them so that they're best prepared for the deployment itself. So as I mentioned, these are all high-stress groups, and we want to work with them and see if there's ways in which we might protect their attention, not only so that their training is optimal and their learning is optimal, but so that at the end of this intensive, demanding period of preparation, they're able to perform well, whether it's taking final exams or actually being deployed to a war zone. We want to make sure attention is in peak shape. So let's broaden our conversation a little bit, and we'll return back to some of the studies we've done with these populations. I'd like to just review with you some of the key questions we're going to be covering. First, I'd like to tell you a little bit and talk to you about what cognitive training is, this notion that our cognitive functions of attention and working memory, these workhorse systems of our brain, we want to find out if they can be trained and what that even means. And then narrow in a little bit on the topic of attention. How does it work in the brain? How are we able to perform well under pressure? And how does our attention system allow us to do so? And then we'll finally talk about sort of the heart of the matter, which is mindfulness training. Is this an effective cognitive training tool? If so, how does it actually work in the brain? And what impact does it have on our cognitive performance? So we'll go through each of these key questions in turn. And now I'd like to take a little bit of an historical journey with you. How is it that we've come to even ask such questions? So let's take our mind back in time a little bit. Let's say a little bit over 100 years ago. At this point in our history, if anybody said that in 100 years, people would willingly get on a bicycle that's had its back wheel removed to pedal as hard and fast as they can for 30 minutes at a time to get nowhere, we would have thought this was absolutely preposterous. Nobody would do this. But of course, every day people take spinning classes, right? This is something we do, and we might do it quite frequently, maybe 3 times a week, 4 times a week. So the question is this: why do people do this? Why do we engage in this type of activity, this type of daily physical activity? And part of the answer is this: in today's day and age, we all have the very clear cultural understanding that physical activity is necessary for physical health. Our leaders, our public policy experts, for whether it's the Center for Disease Control or disease prevention, the Surgeon General of the United States, for example, these are all resources that we go to as our public health officials to provide us with exquisite and precise evidence-based guidance on what we can do to keep our bodies physically fit, right? So whether it's 30 minutes a day, a couple of days a week, or an hour and 15 minutes of rigorous exercise, there are prescriptions that we get from our medical professionals on what we need to do to keep the body physically fit. It's so common and so prevalent at this point that anyone, if asked this question, does physical activity improve physical health, would say, of course, it's obvious. And I think that there's a lot to say about this. It says a lot about sort of the cultural norms we hold of how to preserve and work with our own wellness. So let's shift gears here a little bit. Let's try to understand why it is that we're able to hold such a cultural norm. And this is where people like me, scientists, researchers, I think have had a very big role to play. I would argue that one of the reasons this is our common cultural understanding is because the evidence base is quite robust. In fact, since 1980, there have been over 300,000 articles that have been published on the topic of physical exercise and physical health. And how is this large and vast research literature actually parsed? We could think of it as kind of folded into four different silos of research that, of course, talk to each other. The first is to see what the physiologic effects are on the body when somebody's engaged in exercise, right? How is it that the heart rate changes, that that blood pressure changes? And we can observe the kind of systematic changes that happen while engaging in exercise. Or we can take somebody who's quite physically fit, an athlete, bring them into the laboratory and just see what they look like in terms of their resting functioning. What's their baseline heart rate, right? And this allows us to get a sense of what a very well-trained person who has physical exercise as part of their daily routine, what health benefits they may enjoy. We can also look at structural changes in the body. So how is it that the physical structures, the muscles, for example, change as a function of engaging in daily exercise? And of course, the last sort of area, which is probably the one that most of us care about the most, is our ability to perform and behave in the world. Whether it's the goal to be in a 5K or a half marathon or a marathon, or just your ability to walk up and down the stairs with ease without any pain or a sense of your health not being in optimal conditions. All of these different research aspects lead us to being able to say exactly why it is that physical exercise is necessary for physical health. And I'm really using this to set up where we are today with regard to another very important topic, which is our mind. So let's take a step back and think about what it might be that the body needs or enacts as a function of getting physically fit. Basically, it's this concept of plasticity, that engaging in certain behaviors will change the nature of the body's tissues, its muscles, its skeletal structure, and all of that gives it more pliability and more excellence in wellness as it functions. So we've been talking about the body. Let's now switch gears to talking about the brain and ask a broad question. Does mental exercise improve brain health? And if so, we might want to understand how. How do we train the brain? There are many ways in which people may choose to do this on their own. And unfortunately, there's a lot of lore around this idea that playing brain games like puzzles or Sudoku might actually help the brain, but it doesn't seem to be the case, I'm very sorry to tell you. And really, even before we dig in onto successful and evidence-based approaches that there may be to training the brain, it's important to consider why people choose to do this anyway. Why do we want to train the brain? We've asked many people this question in our research studies, and it breaks down into three main categories of reasons that motivate people to train the brain. These essentially boil down to people want to feel better, they want to perform better, or they want to age better. What does that really mean? Well, in terms of feeling better, it has to do with our psychological health. We'd like to engage in some form of brain training to improve our psychological well-being. When it comes to performing better, it may be cognitive functioning that we want to see is improved through brain training. And finally, with regard to aging, we want to see if there's something we could do on a regular basis in the same way we might engage in physical activity for our physical health. We may want to engage in brain training to protect against age-related diseases such as Alzheimer's disease. So those are the three main reasons people say they'd like to train their brain: feel better, perform better, age better. And of course, we can go beyond this to just the self-interest. Many of us want to have our brains in peak shape so we can be a better service and better use to our world, right? Whether it's being more effective in our job or as a parent or a spouse, being more resilient to the challenges that life brings us, being more giving or kind or connected, experiencing more awe and joy in our lives. There are many reasons we'd like to train the brain. This is just giving us a sampling of what that is. So with these lofty goals, but I would hope achievable goals of how to improve our brain function, let's start moving into what we can do to train our brains and what is actually available to us right now, sort of in the open marketplace to do this. As we think about this, know that all of these different forms of training that we'll talk about in a few minutes hinge on this notion that the brain is able to be changed through experience and training. And this is captured by the term neuroplasticity. So in the same way we talked about plasticity in the body, right, of ways of changing and improving the functioning of tissues, cells, our skeletal structure, neuroplasticity has to do with changing the structure and function of the brain to improve its functioning as well. And in particular, what we're going to do is look to see at benchmarks of neuroplasticity. Are there brain structural changes and are there brain functional changes that correspond to any form of brain training we might introduce to our participants in a research study, for example? In the broad topic of neuroplasticity, we're very interested in seeing how the experience and activities that the human brain engages in may alter brain structure and function. And researchers became very interested in this topic. Broadly, we wanted to see if there were individuals who might have a type of daily life experience, maybe through their profession, that might lead their brain structure to actually be different than most of us. One very intriguing group was cab drivers, in particular, cab drivers who had to negotiate the circuitous landscape of the city streets of London. Think about what it would mean. If you've ever visited the city of London, you know it's quite dense. The streets are circuitous. It's not laid out on a nice Cartesian map. So it will be very difficult for people to know how to get from point A to point B unless they're highly familiar with this jungle of streets. So it ends up that London cab drivers have to have 3 years of formal training to get very well familiar with the maps of the city. And after they do this, of course, they might spend many years being a cab driver. So in one study that was done to look at this notion that exercising the brain, engaging in certain activities in the brain may change its structures, involved London cab drivers. The reason they were chosen is because it ends up that there's a very specific brain structure called the hippocampus that is involved in spatial navigation and spatial maps. So the researchers decided that they were going to scan the brains using structural MRI of London cab drivers. They were going to hone in on the structure of the hippocampus and see if there were any structural differences between cab drivers and other types of drivers in the city of London. In particular, they were going to compare cab drivers who had to negotiate and navigate unknown routes with bus drivers who also drove all day but had very well-defined paths on which they went back and forth. So what was found was that indeed there are brain differences between cab drivers and London bus drivers. And it's in the direction you might expect. Cab drivers had larger hippocampi, which means that the hippocampus, left and right hippocampi too, was more densely packed, looked like it had more cells. It was structurally looked healthier or more robust than the same structure within bus drivers. What was even more striking was that this size of the hippocampus was tied to how many years they'd actually been a cab driver. The longer time they'd spent on the streets of London negotiating and navigating, the larger the hippocampus. This was a very exciting finding because it suggested to us that there was some correspondence between how the brain is organized and the way and manner in which people spend their moments of their life. Cab drivers have more robust hippocampi. Now, this notion of experience altering or shaping the brain is actually not unique to cab drivers. It ends up that if you look at the brains of people that play video games, Tetris, for example, which also involves navigation and spatial maneuvering of just pieces on a screen as you play the video game, or people that engage in juggling as a regular hobby or even a profession, tend to have hippocampi that look healthier and more robust than matched control groups, age and education matched control groups that don't engage in that activity. So what we learn from the London cab drivers is that indeed, it looks to be the case that those that engage in taxi driving as their profession many hours a day for many years actually have a brain structure that's different from bus drivers. It's a very elegant and simple way to see how driving itself may not cause the brain change, but the spatial navigation demands may change it. Now, there's something really important to realize about this study. Though it does a very nice job connecting a particular brain structure to function, it is really relying on an opportunistic, naturalistic type of an experiment. We didn't recruit drivers in London to be part of the study. We actually sought out people that happened to have this as their profession. So, for example, individuals who may choose to drive taxis versus those that may choose to drive buses. We call this a cross-sectional study, so that we're taking individuals who just happen to be different because of their life circumstances. We're not asking them to engage in any particular training. Cross-sectional studies allow us to compare distinct groups of people so we can ask specific research questions. So cross-sectional study designs are great because they're opportunistic. They allow us to benefit on what's happening. But here's a really important thing to keep in mind. Who decides to become a cab driver, right? I know for myself, I don't have great spatial navigation skills. If it weren't for my GPS, in some sense, I might be lost often. It's not something I would choose to do where I would say I'm relying on my own strengths to choose my profession. What if it's the case that people that choose to be cab drivers, especially those who are successful at it and maintain a career in this profession for many years, happen to just have hippocampi that are larger? It becomes a cause and effect question. It may not be that the driving and the circuitous route navigation leads to the structural change. It may be that people choose to do this type of a job because they already have larger hippocampi that allows them to do this well. And that brings up a lot of questions with regard to what brain plasticity, neuroplasticity, actually is. Cross-sectional studies may not allow us the strongest test of brain plasticity because of this type of design limitation. So what's a better way we might ask the question of whether experience and training changes the brain? One very common way in which this is conducted, I would say it's the gold standard of how research is conducted, is something called the randomized control trial. What happens in this type of a research design is that people are invited into the study who have an interest in a broad topic, let's say brain training. And then from those individuals, they are randomly assigned to be in a condition of interest, let's say a particular brain training protocol, and some other condition, whether it's doing nothing at all, which we'd call a no training control group, or an active comparison control group. Let's say it's a group that decides that they won't do brain training in terms of computer-based brain training, but they may choose to do brain training by watching movies or reading books. So we have the treatment of interest, and then the control condition is the comparison. Now, what's really a neat thing about this design is that we can match very well the type of individuals in each of these groups. And then we have them go through the training program itself. Let's say it's an 8-week program, and they get daily engagement in the training itself. One group gets brain training, one group watches movies, and then at the end of that 8 weeks, we would evaluate them again and look to see if the groups differ. The idea would be that if our hypothesis is correct and brain training, for example, improves functioning more so than watching movies or reading books, we might expect to see a group difference at the end of our training period of time. So that's what we call a randomized control trial. Another description of this is a longitudinal study because we're following them over time. Why do I mention this? Well, we talked about London cab drivers and cross-sectional studies. I'd like to move to a randomized control trial that was done in the context of brain training. This is a study that was very much interested in seeing if we could change brain function, improve brain function as a product of people engaging in the research study itself. This study involved a very popular way that people choose to engage in brain training, using computer-based programs and more recently computer-based apps on their phone. This is a very popular industry. In fact, it's valued at about a $1 billion industry, billion with a B. So a lot of effort and financial investment is going into this strategy for brain training. And within my field of cognitive neuroscience, this is probably one of the most hotly studied topics, brain training and the benefits of brain training. So I'd like to share with you one particular study that was done to see the effectiveness of brain training. Now remember, as an attention researcher, my strong interest is in seeing if the brain's attention system can be trained with a program that's intended to make it stronger and more robust. Of all of these different brain training apps that are available, one that is commonly used and that was studied in the research study I'd like to tell you about is called Lumosity. And what they did in this study is that they invited people, participants in, randomly assigned them to receive Lumosity for 70 days or engage in a fun, intensive video game playing time for 70 days. One was intended to be brain training. The other was just intended to match for the amount of screen time and engagement the person might experience. The intention for the Lumosity program's brain training protocol was to improve attention and we could say attention-related processes that might eventually help a person be better at decision-making in the real world. So the intention was always to see if brain training in this way helps our real-world performance. In fact, that's why most would say they do it. They want to be better outside the scope of just getting better at the game. So what happened in this study? They tracked folks over 70 days, as I said, and every day they'd get an index from the Lumosity program itself that described their performance. Overall, everyone showed an improvement over 70 days. Their scores went up and up and up and up, and at some point they plateaued, but it showed a strong learning and improvement effect, which was very encouraging. The other aspect of what they learned is that how much time and an effort people spent engaging in this brain training protocol really impacted how much they benefited. People that had low adherence and didn't always do the assigned homework didn't improve quite as much as those that had high adherence, which makes a lot of sense if you think of the analogy of deciding to do marathon training and only preparing a few days or weeks in advance versus 4 or 5 months, you might expect to perform better at the marathon or have a better time the more you've invested in preparing. So this seems to be very similar. Longer time spent, fuller engagement, better performance. Very exciting stuff. Now, of course, the true test of whether brain training in this manner is beneficial was not just to see if the Lumosity scores improved. It was to see if the benefits carried over into some other kind of more real-world decision-making task. And so the researchers in this experiment, it was Cable and colleagues, what they did is they had people perform decision-making tasks, in particular a decision-making task called delayed discounting. So it would be something like saying, you can have $20 now, or you can have $40 tomorrow if you wait. And they wanted to see if improving and training these operations through the Lumosity program of attention, of inhibition control, of deliberation, for example, might improve the delayed discounting performance. And the bottom line is it did not. There was no evidence that even though their Lumosity scores improved, that there was any carryover into another type of real-world decision-making task. Quite discouraging, but really important to know. And I wanted to say a little bit about why this might be. It's something we call the problem of generalizability, which is that when there's a good deal of overlap between the training task and the evaluation, we get very strong benefits. In the same way that the Lumosity performance itself on the Lumosity training task improved over 70 days, because the task itself that was used to evaluate whether the training was beneficial was the training task itself. But as we make the overlap between the training context and the evaluation context more and more distant, it seems to be the case that the effects and benefits are weaker, so that by the end, the training in Lumosity had no benefit on a decision-making task. And this problem of generalizability, unfortunately, is not constrained to this study alone. It's a larger problem within the field of brain training. In fact, a recent review paper had this to say about the bottom line of what we know about brain training to date. They say that there's little evidence that training enhances performance on distantly related tasks or that training improves everyday cognitive performance. This was quite a blow to this billion-dollar industry, because what it suggests is that though people may download an app and choose to do it and even get better at doing the brain training games on the app, it has virtually no impact on the rest of their lives. And this probably means it's not worth their time, because nobody's playing these games really for the express purpose of getting better at playing them alone. So what we've discussed so far is that cognitive training is a tricky topic. It can actually be elusive in some ways. We talked about cross-sectional studies in which different groups may be involved into a research design to see if there's a correspondence between frequently performed activities and brain changes. We also talked about computer-based training and the lack of evidence that there is actually successful generalizability for this. So I'd like to move now to the topic of mindfulness training and really ask the broad question, can we think of mindfulness training as brain training?
Lecture 12, Mindfulness as Brain Training.
We want to ask the broad question, can we think of mindfulness training as a form of brain training? Well, I think before we delve into the details of whether this is can be answered in a way that's yes or no, we need to understand more fully what I mean when I use the term mindfulness training, and maybe even more broadly, what mindfulness is. So from my point of view, a great way to think about mindfulness requires the use of a simple metaphor. You could think of maybe a simple MP3 player or a video player with a fast forward, a reverse, and a play button. When I think of the term mindfulness, I'm actually talking about a mental mode, a way of making the mind that's characterized by attention to our present moment experience without elaboration or emotional reactivity. Now, why the MP3 player metaphor? Well, I think that mindfulness can be thought of as a mode quite contrary to what the mind typically does. Typically, we can see our mind as being fantastic at mental time travel. We can rewind the mind to reflect on events that have already happened, or we can fast forward the mind to plan and think about the future. And we very easily and unfortunately quite often will see ourselves not in the present moment, but engaging in this rewind or fast forward. So when we think about mindfulness, it is about keeping that button right on play so we're fully living and experiencing the moment-to-moment unfolding of our lives. And what we want to understand is what type of training may be required in order to cultivate a more mindful way of being. And in particular, if somebody engages in this type of training, we want to understand if we can think of it as brain training, or put more plainly, if mindfulness training is training the brain, what is it training? What specific functions may it be strengthening? To understand this, as neuroscientists, we need to look under the hood in the same way that understanding cab drivers and spatial navigation or Lumosity and other brain training programs require us to know what it is that the person is engaging in as the mental training tool, we need to understand how it is that mindfulness training is cultivated through mindfulness exercises. So an example I'd like to give you to give us a deeper dive and deeper understanding of this is a foundational practice common to most exercise programs in mindfulness training, something called mindfulness of breathing. And I'm just going to describe this to you in broad brush strokes so you get a sense of the sequence of events that needs to happen in this type of an exercise. You can think in many ways of mindfulness of breathing as sort of the central push-up of a mindfulness training program, the foundational exercise. In a mindfulness of breathing exercise, the instructions are quite simple, but if you've ever tried to engage in this exercise, you'll understand it's not easy. So what's required? For a dedicated period of time, the instruction is to pay attention to sensations tied to one's breathing. And the first part of this instruction is to be very specific, to select a particular sensation, whether it's the coolness of air moving in and out of your nostrils or your abdomen moving down, up and down, it's something tied to breathing itself. To select that sensation and then to maintain your attention on that sensation for the period of time you're going to engage in the practice. So let's say 10 to 15 minutes. The next important aspect of the instruction, after you've selected and are now maintaining this breath-related sensation, is to notice if the mind has drifted away, if the mind has wandered away. And when you notice that it has, the instruction is to simply return your attention back. So these three main components of select, maintain, and notice are going to be what we might consider the central driving hypotheses of how we think mindfulness training may be altering the brain. We can say that the larger question Is it the case that mindfulness training is allowing for process-specific training of attention? And in order to understand what I mean by this, I think it's important that you get a sense of what we know about the broad field of attention research, because much is known about the common brain circuitry responsible for these different aspects of attention, aspects such as selecting, noticing, maintaining. So let's talk about that, different varieties of attention. And I think to delve into this topic, it's also useful to have a few metaphors that we can use.